Hello, and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. I'd like to update you with more details on the Pardes Executive Learning Seminar, which will be occurring this June 29th through July 3rd in Jerusalem. The Pardes Executive Learning Seminar is geared to business executives, professionals, and leaders who wish to combine visiting Israel with an immersion into the study of classical Jewish sources. The seminar provides the opportunity to discover the relevance of our ancient texts within the inspirational setting of Jerusalem. This year's seminar includes a visit to Dr. Eilat Mazar's recent excavations in Jerusalem City of David and to the nearby Elah Valley where David defeated Goliath. The theme of the seminar is the lives, loves, and legacy of King David. Topics will include power, politics, family ties, and corruption. Has anything changed since ancient times? Fathers and sons, husbands and wives, lovers and rivals. What does David's legacy teach us about relationships? Michal, Bathsheba, and Yonatan. How do we understand David's many loves? Jerusalem, is it still the political and spiritual capital of the Jewish people? And the sword and the book, are they complementary or contradictory? Can one get the job done while upholding biblical ethics? Presenters for the seminar include Rabbi Meir Schweiger, Rabbi Daniel Landis, and other rabbis and teachers. The seminar's tuition is $750, which includes lunches and I believe also one or two dinners. So I urge you to check out all the details. They're on the Pardes website and make this a year to study Torah in Jerusalem with Pardes this summer. There are many other summer programs available at Pardes this summer, and I'll be discussing some of them in forthcoming podcasts. This week, it's a special podcast on Purim by Rabbi Meir Schweiger. Rabbi Meir Schweiger is a senior faculty member of Pardes, and he serves as the Pardes Mashkiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide for Pardes. And now, Rabbi Meir Schweiger.
Thank you, Larry. This week, we will be celebrating the Festival of Purim. Instead of looking at this week's parsha, Parshat Tzav, I would like to examine the historical development of the celebration of Purim. So let us begin by looking at chapter 9, verse 17 in Megillat Esther. And it was on the 13th day of the month of Adar, and I will add parenthetically, that the Jews engaged their enemies in battle. And they rested on the 14th day, and they made it into a day of drinking and rejoicing. And in verse 18, and the Jews in Shushan gathered on the 13th day of the month and on the 14th day. And they rested on the 15th day. And they made it into a day of drinking / partying and rejoicing. Note the fact that the two verses which I just read describe the initial celebration of Purim, of those Jews who were just victorious over their enemies. How are they celebrating? They are celebrating in what would be seen as a typical Persian fashion, drinking and rejoicing. From chapter 1 of Megillat Esther, we know that drinking / partying is very much characteristic of Persian society. The king makes a party which lasts for 180 days. Wine flows according to the hand of the king. People drink to their heart's desire. Now let us move on to verse 19. Therefore, the Jews who live in the unwalled cities make the 14th day of the month of Adar a day of rejoicing, of drinking, Yom Tov, a festive day, and the sending of portions, a man to his fellow. This verse is now looking at the next year, or maybe I should add, the following years. Not the initial celebration, but an attempt to somehow commemorate this event. Note the fact that this commemoration was undertaken on a grassroots level by the Jews living in the unwalled cities. It could very well be that these were the people who felt the most threatened, who therefore experienced the redemption, and therefore felt the need to somehow commemorate this miraculous event. And note the changes which they made to the original celebration. Three changes. First, there is a reversal of the initial celebration. First, there is rejoicing. Afterwards, there is the drinking. Secondly, there is Yom Tov. Third, there is the sending of portions of a man to his fellow. What is the significance of these changes? It would seem to be that the Jews are attempting to put the celebration of Purim into a Jewish context, to infuse it with Jewish values. If Purim is going to be an ongoing celebration, it needs to be given Jewish content. Yom Tov. The rabbis in the Talmud, in Masechet Megillah, define Yom Tov as prohibition of work. And they understand that initially, the Jews declared that no work should be done on Purim, similar to the three festivals, to Rosh Hashanah, where there is a fundamental prohibition of work. Mishloach manot ish l'reyehu, sending portions of food to one's friend. Yom Tov, the prohibition of work, would seem to highlight a dimension of relationship between man and God. By not doing work, we acknowledge that God is the creator. By making Purim into a day which is a Yom Tov, it is somehow trying to introduce the element of God in the events of Purim. As we know, the name of God does not appear in Megillat Esther. Mordechai and Esther are the driving forces behind the victory which the Jews experienced over their enemies. It would be very easy to ignore the role of God in what happened. By making Purim into a Yom Tov, there is an attempt to bring God into the events of Purim. On the other hand, by adding Mishloach Manot Ish L'Reyehu, there is an attempt to make Purim into a holiday of community building. When Haman originally attempted to convince Achashverosh to destroy the Jews, I mentioned this in the podcast 2 weeks ago, his claim was that the Jews are a divided and divisive people. Am mefuzar u'meforad bein hagoyim. When Esther goes before the king to plead the case of the Jews, she tells Mordechai, Lech knos et kol hayudim. Go and gather all the Jewish people. And as I mentioned a few weeks ago, the strength of the Jewish people is reflected in their unity. Hence, it makes a lot of sense to commemorate Purim by doing things that will bond people together. The sending of gifts, but not just gifts, portions of food. Portions of food bring people together to eat together, not only to drink together. And perhaps this also explains the reversal of the words simcha and mishteh. In Persian society, drinking is what enables people to be happy. Drinking, which on certain levels brings about an escape from reality, is what brings about their happiness. But it seems that in the Jewish context, the happiness is created by Yom Tov, by Mishloach Manot. The drinking is put into a much larger context. And this was the attempt by the Jews in the unwalled cities as they began to make Purim a yearly celebration. Now we go to the next stage. Verse 20. And Mordechai wrote all these things and sent out books to all the Jews in all the countries of the king Achashverosh, near and far. Verse 21, in order to establish to them that they should celebrate the 14th day of the month and the 15th day of the month every year, according to the days that the Jews rested from their enemies. The month which was changed, reversed, from sorrow to rejoicing, from mourning to celebration. And now the key, to make those days days of drinking, rejoicing, sending gifts to one's neighbor, and gifts to the poor. What is this third stage? It is no longer a grass movement. It is Mordechai, in his official capacity as second to the king, who is now sending out an edict, institutionalizing Purim. It is no longer just the Jews in the unwalled cities, but to all the Jews. It is not something which is being done year by year, but something which is meant to be institutionalized from now on. And what is the nature of the celebration which Mordechai is institutionalizing? And once again, we find three differences. First of all, Mordechai wants the Jews to celebrate the 14th and the 15th. It is unclear whether that means all the Jews will be celebrating 2 days, or whether some people celebrate one day, others another day. If we take the text at face value, it would seem to be that everyone is celebrating 2 days. Why 2 days? To commemorate not only the general victory, but also the specific victory of the people of Shushan. First difference. Second, Mordechai eliminates the element of Yom Tov. Purim will not be a day where there is a prohibition of work. And instead of Yom Tov, Mordechai adds Matanot la'evyonim, gifts to the poor. If I follow the approach, which I mentioned a few moments ago, what Mordechai has done is to somehow eliminate the divine element of Purim and highlighted the human element. Rather than focus on prohibition of work, Mordechai places the emphasis on community building, and perhaps even more significantly, on social responsibility. Not only is there to be camaraderie by sending portions of food to my friends, but maybe more importantly, gifts to the poor, recognizing not only my friends, but those in need. That is the strength of a cohesive community, to be able to empower those at the bottom. And then we find a very interesting development. In verse 23 it says, "And the Jews accepted what they had begun to do and that which Mordechai wrote to them." And once again, if we go by the pshat, the simple reading of the text, one could say that the Jews incorporated all of the elements, so that at that stage, Purim on the one hand is a Yom Tov, on the other hand, there is the communal dimension, which incorporates sending portions of food to one's friend, giving gifts to the poor. Not only the unwalled cities celebrate, everyone celebrates. 2 days. Now let's fast forward a little bit. Verse 27. Kiyemu v'kiblu ha'yudim aleihem. The Jews fulfilled and accepted upon themselves and on their seed, and on all those that would become attached to them, that it should not pass, that they should do these 2 days according to the way they are written in their time every year. What change has happened in this verse? The most significant change is the idea of the Jews accepting the celebration of Purim upon their children, upon all those who join up with the Jews. If Mordechai sent out edicts to institutionalize Purim, one could say that that was for that generation. But now we have the Jews who are taking upon themselves the celebration of Purim for future generations, who are extending the celebration of Purim to to those who join the Jewish people, who convert, so that the scope of this celebration is widely increased. Note the fact that there is a very interesting dynamic in the development of the holiday between top to bottom, bottom to top. There seems to be something very powerful about the Jewish people accepting upon themselves the celebration of this holiday. It is not just something that was legislated, but something that was actually embraced by the general rank and file. And if I go back to how we began, the initial celebration of Purim the year later, the year after, was undertaken by the Jews in the unwalled cities, one could argue, by the rank and file. Mordechai, at a certain point, steps on the scene, issues an edict, but ultimately, the importance of his action is a function of the acceptance of the Jewish people. And as I just read in verse 27, the Jewish people take it one step further. They extend the celebration to their children after them. And now we come to the next phases. Verse 28. And these days shall be remembered and done in each generation, by each family, each country, each city. And the days of Purim shall not pass over, pass through the Jewish people, and their memory will never end from their seed. Let me point out two things in this verse. First of all, the delineation of each generation, each family, each country, each city. The rabbis understand this to be saying that, in fact, the celebration of Purim was not done uniformly. Different cities celebrated differently. And this perhaps became the basis for the reading of the Megillah, the celebration of Purim, on different days. The general population celebrating on the 14th day of Adar, and walled cities celebrating on the 15th. And certainly nowadays, the quintessential walled city, Jerusalem, celebrating on the 15th day of Adar. Something which I just slipped out in explaining this verse is actually central to this verse. And that is the second point. Up to this point, we have been speaking about the days being celebrated, being done, osim. This is the first time where it mentions that not only are the days done, but the days are remembered. And the memory is emphasized at the end of the verse as well. What is meant by remembering the days of Purim? The rabbis in Masechet Megillah understand this to be an allusion to the reading of the Megillah. This past Shabbat, we had a special Torah reading, the Maftir, Parshat Zachor. Remember what Amalek did to you. How does one remember? The rabbis say the way that you remember is verbally. How do we know that? Well, in the section which we read this past Shabbat, it says, at a certain point, don't forget. So the rabbis say, don't forget means mentally. Remembering is more active. How does one do that? Verbally. But then the rabbis take it one step further and say, there is a verse in the original battle against Amalek in Exodus, chapter 17, verse 14, where Moses is told in the aftermath of the battle, write this down as a remembrance in the book. And from this we derive that one remembers by reciting from a book. On the one hand, this is what we did last Shabbat when we read Parshat Zachor. That is how we remember the battle against Amalek, by reading it from a Sefer Torah. By extrapolation, the rabbis see in chapter 9, verse 28 of Megillat Esther, the hint that not only is Purim celebrated by doing the various things, but also by remembering, i.e., reading the Megillah. And this actually leads us to the last few verses, where all of a sudden Esther, comes into the picture. And Esther and Mordechai write down in a special letter which is sent out that the Jews should be celebrating, fulfilling the days of Purim. And in the very end of chapter 9, it says, and it was written down in the book. Once again, in the Talmud, the rabbis see Esther as being the driving force behind commemorating the events of Purim in a book. And it's for this reason that the book is known as Megillat Esther. Not only because she is the heroine of the story, but because she is the one who saw it being essential that these events be documented. And hence, the final stage in the celebration of Purim is the reading of the Megillah. What makes the reading of the Megillah so important? The reading of the Megillah is an expression of study. What makes the events, the celebration, so important is that before we do something, we should understand why we're doing it, what it is that we are celebrating. If I mentioned to you earlier that the rabbis tried to put Purim, the celebration of Purim, into some type of Jewish framework, let us note a very interesting analogy between the celebration of Purim and the celebration of Pesach. The Seder, which we are all familiar with, is based on the telling of a story. By analogy, Purim has to do with the telling of a story. Interestingly, the telling of the story on the Seder, at the Seder, is done nowadays from a book. But it doesn't have to be done from a book. We don't have to read the story. In fact, ideally the Seder should be told in our own words. There is a lot of room for creativity. The book is read at the meal, the story is told at the meal. But in Purim, we read the story from a book. It is very important that it be read carefully from that book. There is no room for telling the story in our own words. It is not read at the meal. It is read earlier, before that. So there is a parallelism, but there is also a difference. Why is there such an emphasis on the book? Perhaps it is connected with the story of Esther coming at a very critical junction in Jewish history. It is a coming at the end of the period of prophecy, of the written word, in the aftermath of the destruction of the first temple, during the period of the second temple, the beginning of that period. The book of Esther closes that literature which is known as Torah Shebichtav. And perhaps Esther felt that it was very important that this story be included in that literature. As I mentioned earlier, the name of God does not appear in the book of Esther. And yet, somehow, it seems that God is very much behind the scenes, orchestrating the different events. The reality of the story of Purim is one in which God is very much in the background, one in which human initiative is placed in the forefront. And perhaps for that reason, that is why we need to understand before we do. The rabbis note that in Purim, there was a second receiving of the Torah. In verse 27, when it says, Ki yimu v'kiblu, the rabbis make a drash. They derive, the Jews accepted that which they had previously received. There was a second receiving of the Torah, the first being at Mount Sinai. What was the difference between the first giving of the Torah and the second receiving of the Torah? The first giving of the Torah was one that was imposed upon the Jewish people, where the Jews heard the voice of God in the metaphoric language of the rabbis, where God held the mountain over their heads and said to them, if you receive my Torah, fine, and if not, may this be your grave. But in the second receiving of the Torah, there is no mountain. There is no word of God. It is the Jews who reinstate their covenant with God. It is the Jews who take the initiative in their salvation, in commemorating the events which happened. And therefore, the idea of writing these events in a book, studying that book, reciting that book, acting upon it, becomes a certain model for the post-First Temple generation, a new reality where God is no longer as active in the world, as visible in the world, a reality where it is incumbent upon us to take initiative, where knowledge is empowering, and where our actions should be informed. In fact, if we go back to the beginning of the story of Purim, the king and his advisors make decisions, act from a framework of partying. When their hearts are good with wine, that's when they make major decisions. Our actions as Jews should not be a function of drinking. It should be a function of reading a book, of understanding. The drinking should be the outgrowth of that understanding, not the source of it. And that is why the reading of the Megillah is so central in the celebration of Purim. To summarize our study, the commemoration of Purim, the establishment of Purim as a holiday for all generations, went through a number of stages. Both the leadership and the grassroots grappled with how to commemorate this holiday, with the question of what is the message that we want people coming out with. In the end, there is no Yom Tov, and by not having Purim being a Yom Tov, it plays down the divine element. The flip side is it plays up the human element. It says to us that redemption, salvation, is in our hands. What brings about our salvation? Two things. A sense of social bonding, coming together as a community, eating together. But not only eating together, but even more importantly, taking care of those who don't have. Matanot le'evyonim. Empowering all those in our society who are lacking. The strength of our society is measured by the weakest link. And therefore it is incumbent upon us to see that there are no weak links, to make sure that everyone has. The second element is understanding. Understanding which leads to action. And now let me add another dimension. A book is important because a book records our history. Once again, the rabbis in the Talmud say, the battle against Amalek is recorded in three places. We read about it this past Shabbat in Deuteronomy and what happened in the desert. In the Haftarah, we fast forwarded to the time of King Saul, who is given the mandate to fight Amalek. And then once again we fast forward to the story of Purim, where the Jews, perhaps against their will, are put in a position where they have to defend themselves against a descendant of Amalek, Haman. The book is very important in terms of our collective memory. The celebration of Purim is very important in making us realize who we are. If we forget that we are Jews, perhaps our enemies remind us of that. On the one hand, there is a need to have to defend ourselves against our enemies. But more importantly, there is a need for us to see ourselves as being Jews, not only in the negative sense, but in the positive sense, as a people with a mission, as a people who are determined to build a model society, and ultimately as the people of the book, not only the book of Esther, the book of the Torah. And I will end with something which is relevant to our parsha, or maybe I should say to the book of Vayikra. The book of Vayikra is very often referred to as Torat Kohanim, the book of the priests. And the explanation is because the book deals with many laws that have to do with the priests, with sacrifices, with ritual purity. But on a much deeper level, the book of Vayikra is concerned with how we build a Jewish society, a model Jewish society. in the words of chapter 19 in the book of Shemot, how do we become a Mamlechet Kohanim, the Goy Kadosh, a kingdom of priests and a holy people? The reading of the book of Esther is supposed to remind us who we are and to get us to thinking who we need to become. What in fact makes us different from your average Persian? What makes our culture different from the culture described in the Megillah? How do we make informed decisions, moral decisions? How do we make sure that we don't get caught up with all the externals, but are able to appreciate what really matters? When we celebrate Purim this year, we should all ask ourselves, who are we? And what society do we want to become? And how do we make sure that in the end, we have truly learned something from the reading of the book? Purim Sameach, Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Your comments on the podcast are always appreciated. Please send your emails to podcasts@pardesusa.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.